presidential election. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight, after millions of Malawians voted yesterday in the country's rerun election, ballot counting has begun. And health workers say the coronavirus and restriction movements in Kenya have led to an increase in violence against women. All these and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. A study in South Africa has shown that people with HIV and tuberculosis are about 2.5 times more likely to die of COVID-19 than people without the conditions. Although the risk presented by the coronavirus to HIV and TB-infected individuals is lower than expected, scientists say the pandemic is causing South Africa's HIV and TB rates to increase. Darren Taylor has more.
When Professor Gavin Churchyard talks about TB, people around the world listen. The specialist physician has been investigating the disease in South Africa, one of the globe's TB epicenters, for decades. Churchyard's also the founder of the Aurum Institute, which focuses on TB and HIV service delivery, management, and research.
COVID-19 may worsen both TB treatment outcomes as well as exacerbate post-TB lung disease, given that both attack the lungs.
He says the full extent to which COVID-19 has impacted on South Africa's TB and HIV epidemics can only be measured once the coronavirus crisis is over. Like many countries, South Africa has directed most of its health resources to the fight against COVID-19 and away from TB, for example.
The impact of the COVID-19 response on TB has been to reduce the number of diagnostic tests for TB by about half. It's also substantially reduced the number of patients treated for TB, the number of contact investigations done. Preventive therapy services have largely been neglected.
This is extremely concerning, says Churchyard, given that TB is already the leading cause of natural death in South Africa. The state estimates it kills about 175 people every day. A global initiative called the Stop TB Partnership has examined the impact of the coronavirus response on the disease's control in Kenya. Churchyard says the results are relevant to South Africa. The analysis showed that a lockdown of 2 months had a modest impact on a TB epidemic.
However, if the lockdown was extended to 3 months, then the impact was substantial and prolonged. The more prolonged the lockdown is and the more intensive it has been, the greater the impact will be on TB-related deaths.
This applies to South Africa, where a hard lockdown was indeed enforced for 3 months. Churchyard says scientific modeling presents the world with a frightening future in terms of its efforts to eliminate TB.
And over a period between 20 and 2025, the 3-month lockdown with a protracted 10-month restoration period could lead to additional 6.3 million cases of TB and 1.4 million TB deaths.
He says many of these TB fatalities will be in Southern Africa, a regional death toll that will dwarf that of the COVID-19 pandemic.
During this lockdown period, when people can't access diagnostic and treatment services for TB, the number of TB cases that are undetected, contributing to ongoing TB transmission, increases.
But, says Churchyard, there is some good news in the field of HIV in South Africa.
And although we saw a decline as we went into lockdown, the number of people who do actually start antiretroviral therapy has continued to increase.
His message to the authorities is, even though you have to combat COVID-19, you also have to keep HIV and TB testing, treatment, and prevention in place. Otherwise, you'll be facing a scenario where the coronavirus threat is largely eliminated, yet the health of millions will be in even greater jeopardy. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
After millions of Malawians voted yesterday in the country's rerun election, ballot counting has begun at the 5,000 polling stations. Incumbent President Peter Mutharika, 79, is running against Lazarus Chakwera, 65, leader of the main opposition, Malawi Congress Party, and two other candidates. Both the ruling party and Chakwera's party have lodged minor complaints about the vote. It was on February 3rd that the country's constitutional court struck down Mutharika's victory in the May 2019 election, citing evidence of voter fraud. Malawi's Electoral Commission chairperson, Chifondo Kachale, has assured voters that this time around the polling process would be fair. A number of local and international organizations are observing the election to ensure that's the case. The Malawi Election Commission says it has 8 days to announce the official results. 50% of the vote is needed to clinch outright victory. Akila Saleh, the Speaker of Libya's House of Representatives, announced today that the strife-torn countries will formally request Egypt's military intervention if necessary. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi says direct intervention in Libya would have international legitimacy at this point. While he emphasized that Egypt has no ambitions in Libya, he warned that Sirte and al-Jufra are considered the red line for Egyptian national security, not to be crossed by forces of the Government of National Accord in Tripoli. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi discussed these developments with Rionan Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis.
I think in many senses it is accurate in the sense that Egypt, although it has an interest in Libya and is involved in Libya as its close regional partner, hasn't really shown in the past any real desire to expand its military control into Libya or to really further extend any of its other aspects. So, for example, we've seen in the conflict in Tripoli, although it has been a key ally of the LNA, it hasn't deployed actively its forces on the ground up until now. Egypt, really, the most important aspect about Libya is the security of the Egyptian-Libyan border and the security of eastern Libya, which is the part that borders Libya, and Egypt's main concern really is about security, both in terms of Turkey or the GNA or kind of anti-Egypt Islamist groups being able to penetrate into Egypt, influence Egypt from eastern Libya, but also about the bigger picture regional dynamics, this kind of Islamist, anti-Islamist dynamic that Egypt is concerned that if Turkey in particular is able to expand its control over a larger area of Libya, this will give it greater influence over the Libyan government, the current going up national accord in Tripoli, and could tip that regional balance away from kind of Egyptian interests.
Well, Sisi also warned that Libya's Sirte and al-Jufra are considered the red line for Egyptian national security. Help us understand why.
So the important thing about Sirte and Jufra is that they lie down the center of Libya. Sirte is on the coast, Jufra is further down to the south in the desert. And as such, they mark a kind of almost de facto partition between eastern and western Libya. The key thing about Sirte is that it's the last kind of major defendable town, city location before the so-called oil crescent, which is where the majority of Libya's oil ports are and where most of the oil is exported from. Therefore, if the GNA and Turkey are able to take control of Sirte, they will likely be able to push much further east and take control of the oil ports, which will give them a great deal of leverage, but also give them easier access to eastern Libya. Likewise with Jufra, and this is the kind of main central airbase that the LNA and its allies control in central Libya. Similarly, if the GNA were to take control of that, they will be able to project power into this central Libyan area much more easily, and the area of influence controlled by the LNA would be much reduced. And again, this would feed into that threat perceived by Egypt, and that kind of boundary between the sort of Turkish GNA influence and its own influence would be much reduced.
So if negotiations resumed at the current lines, how would controlling the oil fields impact the balance of power on the negotiating table?
So the control of the oil fields and the oil ports is very significant, and that is because the LNA has been blockading the oil, which is nearly 80% of in the oil crescent region of Libya's oil output, blockading them since January, and therefore that's had a huge detrimental economic effect on the whole country. So the LNA will likely want to keep control of these oil ports. It won't want to relinquish them, but its main bargaining chip will be to reopen them. So I think from the LNA Eastern perspective, they would want to see a deal struck where they would exchange the reopening of the oil fields but controlling them in exchange for the territory and organising that. However, the GNA, particularly given they've had so much success recently in this kind of military momentum, they will likely want to push so that they control the oil ports so that there's no risk of a kind of LNA blockading them further in the future.
That was Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy. In the Gambia, the government said it would talk with the leadership of the Gambia Transport Union to resolve a dispute over a new regulation limiting the number of passengers commercial drivers can carry. The government said the emergency regulation was part of efforts to combat the coronavirus pandemic. Drivers called off a strike on Monday ahead of talks. Panderambai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Commuters in the Gambia were left stranded Monday when commercial drivers put their vehicles in park to demand that the government relax pandemic controls on the transportation industry. They also want the government to build parking lots for them, among other demands. The spokesman for the Gambia Transport Union said on Kerufatu, an online news operation, that the government has lifted some of the COVID-19 restrictions on social distancing. Mosques and markets have opened and ferries are operating. But he said the government has ignored commercial drivers carrying passengers. He said the union tried to start a dialogue with the government but got no response, so it launched Monday's strike, asking to be able to carry a full load of passengers. Police Superintendent Lamin Jai is the spokesman for the Gambia Police Force. He says the protesting drivers do not represent all Gambian drivers.
There are some drivers that are actually not partaking in the sit-down strike. They want to go about with their lawful business. And so while they go about with their lawful business, there is some group of drivers too. I don't know if they are drivers or people, group of individuals who we believe belong to the other camp. That's the people who are supporting the sit-down strike. And they are obstructing these other people from going about their lawful business.
Njai says traffic was obstructed within the Greater Banjul area because of the drivers' protests. The police later arrested some of the protesters.
Three persons were arrested around the Brusubiton table area for doing the same thing, trying to obstruct other drivers that are going about their lawful business. And also an extra seven were arrested also at the Abuko area around the Tabokoto Junction. They too were trying to obstruct other drivers from going about their lawful business. And so that was the reason why they also got arrested.
The arrested drivers have been granted bail. The Gambian government has called on citizens to observe social distancing even if it reopens some segments of the economy. The country has so far recorded 41 corona cases. 26 patients have recovered and 2 died. For VOA Africa, this is Panderimbai reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Health workers say the coronavirus curfew and restrictions on movement in Kenya have led to an increase in violence against women. Kenya's LVCT group, which works on HIV prevention and reproductive health issues, says economic insecurity is putting stress on families that often explodes into abusive men beating their wives. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
For the past few weeks, 32-year-old Lucy Awur has been visiting a Kenyan government facility that supports women and girls fleeing from abusive men. Life has been tough for me. I don't have peace in my house, she says. Sometimes I have no food for my children, but most of all, my husband beats me in the middle of the night. I don't sleep in peace, Awur says. The mother of four is one of 800 women who reported violence since Kenya announced its first coronavirus case in mid-March. Jen Thiomi works with Elvicity Health, a donor-funded charity group that helps women and girls in abusive situations. She says in February, the group received 123 cases. In the first 6 weeks curfew, they received nearly 800.
Within our systems of change agents, we have had a lot of people reporting violence on a daily basis in this compound. And what we do is just sit with the two, if they're willing to sit, and sort of have a conversation, a negotiation process. Because if somebody is abusing somebody today, they have nowhere to land to.
Kenya's police spokesman Charles Owino says during the COVID-19 pandemic, they are seeing more reports of gender-based violence.
Many a times, the weaker sex is the female, and many a times they become victims. And therefore, we experience a number of cases, a rise in the number of cases where women have been assaulted, abused.
While officials' numbers are not yet compiled, Kenya health workers say they have seen a jump in cases of abuse since mid-March, when a nighttime curfew was put in place to curb COVID-19. Kenyan authorities and aid agencies have blamed the stress from lost income and social distancing for worsening violence at home. For a while, she's tired of the beating and cannot wait for the lockdown to end so that she can flee to the safety of relatives and away from her abusive husband. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The UN Population Fund says many women are reluctant to seek medical care at healthcare facilities for fear they may be exposed to the coronavirus. In Cameroon, a non-profit group of doctors has started to make home visits, the first program of its kind in the country. For VOA, Anne Nuzanonkwe reports from Yaoundé in this story narrated by Moki Edwin Kinzeka.
25-year-old Jan Gono says she has a health condition that requires regular monitoring. But she hasn't been to the hospital for 4 months because she's afraid of being exposed to the coronavirus. Instead, a doctor from non-profit group SOS Doctors Cameroon is visiting her at home. She says she feels safe at home compared to the hospital. When you go to the hospital, says Ngono, you don't know who you are going to meet on the way, the taxis you'll take, who is sick or not. Like Ngono, many people around the world are afraid to go to hospitals, according to the UN Population Fund. Medical experts say they understand this, but urge patients to continue to stay in touch with doctors and hospitals. Dr. Jean Betolin Zambo is with Cameroon's National College of Doctors.
There are initiatives that can apporter un plus and sont pas à rejeter.
He says if there are initiatives that can add value, they should not be rejected. But in his humble opinion, says Zambo, the hospital remains the best place where diagnosis can be made and the patients well-oriented. The group SOS Doctors Cameroon includes 30 doctors in 5 cities. Patients can ask for a consultation on the group's website or Facebook page. A visit costs about $34, twice the price of a hospital consultation. Despite the cost, SOS Doctors Cameroon says requests for home visits have jumped from about 20 in March to about 100 per month. And the medical aid group is continuing to find new ways to provide service, says SOS Doctors Cameroon President Dr. Fernand Ombolo.
On s'est rendu compte qu'il s'agissait plus de consultations de routine qu'autre chose.
He says they realized that it was mostly routine consultations, so it gave them the idea to set up a remote assistance service, which is done by WhatsApp, says Ombolo. It allows patients to chat 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with a doctor, he says, and to ask any type of medical question. The demand is expected to only grow. Cameroon has confirmed nearly 10,000 COVID-19 cases, one of the highest number of known infections in Africa. For Anne Zwanke in Yaoundé, Cameroon, Moki, Edwin Kinzeka, for VOA News.
The coronavirus pandemic has some top flight athletes struggling to stay sharp for next year's Tokyo Olympics after training facilities were shut down and competitions cancelled. Ugandan runner Halima Nakayi, the gold medalist in the 800 meters at the 2019 World Athletics Championships, is doing her best to prepare under the restrictions imposed by COVID-19. Halima Tubani reports from Kampala.
800-meter women's world athletics champion Halima Nakayi is trying to stay in top shape for next year's Tokyo Olympics. With the games postponed and Uganda's gyms and stadiums closed since March to curb the spread of COVID-19, her only option is Kampala's open roads. But the 25-year-old runner says training at home is the least of her worries.
Around January, February, I had got an opportunity to participate in the indoor games, of which the main target was Tokyo. So due to COVID, all the races were cancelled. And the worry, mostly being a lady, my time in sports is so short. So I have to use my body, if it's in position, to deliver good results.
Stuck in Uganda and without international competitions, Nakayi trains with her other runners who are also preparing for the Tokyo Games. They are only allowed to train in small groups to abide by measures to curb the spread of the virus. Another Ugandan runner, Winnie Nanyondo, says the lockdown and delayed Olympics has also been mentally challenging.
We have to focus, we have to remain in training. Because next year is Olympics. This year, there is nothing. Just only Diamond Leagues. And the other year is World Championships.
The Diamond League is a series of top-tier athletic competitions for elite athletes. Most of the competitions have been cancelled, although there is hope one might take place in Monaco this August. Uganda's National Council of Sports admits the pandemic has posed challenges for athletes to stay fit and motivated. Ismail Dakaba is the National Council of Sports spokesperson.
It's been very challenging because in an Olympic year is when the athletes are most fit, I've got to say. That's when their bodies, their minds are in the best shapes of their lives because they are trying to do everything to win Olympic gold or to raise their status. Now, without the Diamond League happening, it's a very unfortunate situation for one reason, that that is where they make most of their money.
These Ugandan athletes hope that restrictions on international competitions can be lifted as soon as possible. Nakayi wants to race at the Diamond League in Monaco in August, assuming that COVID-19 is by then under control. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokibilia Baro, thank you for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny.